Hello and welcome to episode 102 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. So we meet again. We're on the eve. We're recording this on the eve of total political meltdown.
We've recorded all of our episodes for the last few weeks on the eve of total political meltdown.
For the entire time this show has been going, since October 2016, we've been recording it on the eve of total political meltdown. Oh, anyway, I don't know if I can stand any much more of this.
You haven't got much longer to wait. We've only got like 2 weeks or something, haven't we?
2 weeks and then 10 years, maybe 15.
Yeah,
so maybe 20.
Don't worry about it. Just have to accept the new normal and accept that you'll probably expire before they sort all this out.
Oh, there's a great thought. Are you keeping busy?
Oh, good Lord, I am. A really busy week, a really great week last week. And you have, different things going on. But I had spent a couple of days with an IT leadership team going through some of their challenges and how they're going to attack them. And that was really good fun because it's always good to meet new people and help them with their woes. Not that they had woes, really, just had a lot to do, which is great. And I also did a panel. I did a panel for a thing called CIO Crowd, a guy called Jason Woods, who people might know, who has run CW500 events and things like that in the past. And we were talking about, what were we talking about? It was around influence and, you know, what's the role of the CIO in future and all that kind of old stuff that we so often talk about. But it was good, and there were some really good people on the panel made it all even better than just having me there, which is of course just the prerequisite for a good night. But it was really good, and I enjoyed that. Even if the trains were all broken out of Euston on the way home, and I had to go via Marylebone and Birmingham and all those terrible places. But really busy week and really good fun. How about yourself?
Well, of course, the other thing that was for both you and I was that we got sign off on our first client. This is very exciting.
Yeah, that was fun.
I think we sort of vaguely mentioned this in the past, but we've been working on this concept called podcast powered projects, mostly because the alliteration appeals to me. But the idea is about using podcasting as a medium for helping within organisations, people to get better at storytelling and get better at research in a kind of ethnographic way and to be able to communicate more effectively. And we've got our first client of note. So that's all brilliant. And there's more information about that going up at podcastpowerprojects.com if you're interested in finding out more. But that was good. And I also attended a think-in. So there's a thing called Tortoise, which is a news organisation that's been set up in the last year, which prides itself on the idea of slow news, a bit like slow cooking, or slow food. Slow cooking, something slightly different. they've got an online news thing. They do a quarterly printed publication, which I haven't done one of yet, because it only started at the beginning of the year. And they only have like two or three articles a day, and those articles are long form pieces. They're not just news. They're sort of trying to be able to uncover things that are underlying the current news agenda. Some of them very directly, some of them a bit more tangentially. And part of that is they have these events, quite a few of them a month, called think-ins, where they just bring people together who have got an interest in particular subjects and you talk about it. And the only rule is that you're not allowed to ask any questions. So there's no, you know that thing at events where people stand up in the question and answer session and ask a really torturous question that isn't really a question at all, it's just a statement. Well, they've taken that head on and said, no, you can't ask questions. You need to, well, apart from rhetorical questions, I guess. But you have to just be able to contribute. So the one last week was all about the future of working and work culture, which is obviously a bit of a specialised subject for me. And it was very good. And it was even better for the fact that the event ended and James Harding, who's the one of the founders of Tortoise and former head of BBC News, finished off with a little anecdote about how he'd been in a meeting with Bill Gates' speechwriter, and there was this thing up on the wall talking about the things that you could do or not do at work. And at the top of that list was my now, I think, infamous flowchart of the four tops, which I just found utterly enchanting to be able to be quoted like that. And then I had to go up to him afterwards and say, that's mine, you know. So there you go. Anyway, the life of that flowchart will probably outlive the life of me.
You should have been standing up in and proclaiming to everybody that you were the author of it and demanding 5p from everybody for having helped the story. Also, what I was very pleased about last week was to see Pauline Yao and her story in the FT about her flexible movement.
Oh, and yes, because that was the first...
Because I'm calling that the WB40 spin-off, flexible movement, in order to try to get some reflected glory. But the sheer fact is that she's done less than a dozen episodes and is in the Financial Times, and we're on 100 episodes, and nobody's heard of us.
Well, we've got a few people listening. Anyway, we're not going to get mentions in the FT if we carry on whiffling like this, so let's get on with the show with a bit of internet yin and yang. Okay, so we've got a yin and a yang. The yin, this is topical, I think. This is about data protection, GDPR, and the impact of what will happen after we eventually leave the European Union.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is I think I'm cheating a little bit. I think the whole site may have been a yang once upon a time, but I'm calling this a yin because it came across my consciousness in the last few days. In fact, it was only yesterday that this page was updated. So I have definitely mentioned before a site called afterbrexit.tech, which is managed and delivered by the excellent Heather Burns for nothing really other than trying to make sure that we've all got a good view of what the impact of Brexit on the digital sector would be. And the data protection page of this site has got it was updated yesterday, but really it's all about what the current state of play is, how much work the government have done in assessing what will happen after Brexit and what the withdrawal agreement contains, for example, but also what happens in the event of a no-deal Brexit. And since we are now, 20 days, 26 days away or whatever it is from leaving, 18 days, 18 days, 2 hours and 24 minutes. It says at the top of the page on this After Brexit site. So 18 days from now, if nothing else happens, and there's nothing else really being proposed, certainly nothing before Parliament, we will leave the European Union and we will leave it without a deal. And if we do that, just in the terms of data protection, of course, there are lots and lots of other things that we need to be worried about, but just in the terms of data protection, what the UK have said was, well, do you know what? We'll make this as easy as possible because we'll just remove any restrictions on UK data leaving the shores to the EU. We're just going to let that happen, which is, I suppose, one way of stopping any problems. You just remove all of your concerns about personal data. And I suppose it also allows them to point at the EU and say, well, they're going to put the barriers up then, which is a fairly infantile way to behave. The EU, essentially, because there is no legal structure in place, what that means is that, according to Heather, and it seems perfectly reasonable to suggest this, actually, and the government has even said this in so many words in their advice, is that for everybody that then receives personal data from the EU, for about EU citizens, you basically have to set up your own legal structure with whoever you are dealing with, which is okay, fine, you can do that. And lots of companies will be able to do that, but a lot of small companies won't, of course. You don't have lots of commercial lawyers hanging around ready to set yourself up a new data protection contract. So essentially, the whole no-deal Brexit around data protection does rather screw over small companies. And there's a whole bunch of other things that I urge people to read about if you are responsible for data in your organization, because we can all hope that something gets dealt with in between now and then, but the risk of actually hitting this stage is going up by the day.
Yep, I think it's the thing about small businesses in all of this, I think, is lost. Well, actually, no, there's so many things that have been lost throughout all of this, but the inability for small organisations or even, you know, sole trader organisations like you or I, where we just don't have the resources to deal with any of this, and it enables, at the moment, us to be able to have, I mean, I've got business in Europe, I've got clients in Europe, I can't see, I mean, part of the protection I've put in place, because I don't operate as a company, I operate as a sole trader, is getting an Irish passport. I don't know if that's going to be enough for me to continue to be able to work, because I'm not sure how they'll be able to pay me. And it's all these things. It's just that I don't have the time or the resources to be able to give it any real thought. And there will be hundreds, if not thousands, of cases across the country where that will be the case. And it's just going to make it a living hell. And things like data privacy, which we know how influential the European Union is on enforcing this for organisations that exist outside of the EU, as you've been seen witnessed by the things like the cookie permissions that are now on every American website, because they've had to do that to be able to deliver those services into Europe. Not having any influence any over any of this stuff is, well, go us. What a win. Anyway, we're going over old ground there. We'll put the link to Heather's website up on our website. Let's cheer things up a bit. Internet Yang. And this came about, I like to take my kids to the library, because I think it's a good thing for kids to go to the library. They're 8 and 9, particularly the eldest loves reading. And just the thing about going, I used to love going to the library as a kid, and I think actually certainly my eldest enjoys it now as well. He was saying actually just this evening, when I asked him what he'd like to do this weekend, because mum's away with some friends, he said, oh, can we go to the library? So, he's going to get bullied at school. There we go. Anyway, we were in the library and I saw this little flyer. And the flyer was for a service that the libraries here have made available to residents around the area, which is that with just your library card number, you can sign up to a service called RB Digital, which is a online and app-based thing that enables you to be able to get latest editions of a bunch of different magazines, including The Economist and Wired and Radio Times and all sorts on there. And I just thought it was really interesting. I thought it was really good because it's effectively a service that I get for no payment out the back of paying my council tax. But it also started to make me think about, actually, although there is quite rightly great disquiet about the number of libraries that have shut in the last 8 or 9 years under the austerity funding for local authorities in particular, and local authorities have been probably the worst hit of any area of government at all. There isn't really a conversation, I don't think, going on at the moment about what is the future of libraries. And there's the library as a physical place that you can go. But in the future, will libraries be full of books still? Will they be full of magazines? Is that actually a viable way for them to be operating? I found it interesting to think about actually what would a library in 20 years' time look like. I mean, the worst thing would be it would be Amazon Prime. And I don't mean that as a metaphor. I mean, literally, it will be Amazon Prime. And we'll just have turned everything else off. The experience of using this online digital magazine service did make me think, I wonder what else could be.
Mm. Well, I can give you a slightly related example of something I'm working on at the moment, which is around prisons and prison operations. So every prison has a library, and a prison has a library for lots of different reasons. Obviously, it has it for uplifting and perfectly good reasons of having books for people to borrow and read. It also has a library because it's got legal texts in it and case law, because in prisons you have people on remand, for example, awaiting trial. You also have people who are appealing their sentence, and not all of them are always represented by, they're allowed to represent themselves. And since people are allowed to represent themselves, then it would be, it wouldn't be right to deny them access to information that they might need to do that. So prison libraries have a whole number of different things going on in there. And they are really expensive places for prisons to run, because you've got to staff them for a start, but you've also got to provide up-to-date books, up-to-date case law. You've got books that you can borrow, you know, like, you know, Dick Francis books or whatever. But the case law books, generally speaking, that the prisoners can't take out because they're really expensive. You know, you can imagine these legal textbooks, they're bloody expensive. So they stay in the library. So you end up with damaged textbooks, legal textbooks. And so what can you do about that? Well, one thing you can do is you can go out and buy a whole bunch of very cheap e-readers, and you can use the digital versions rather than use paper books, because that allows you then to A, update your books a little bit more dynamically. It means that you can, if you get the latest version, you can put that on there. It also means that you can, for people who can't read so well or need bigger text and things, e-readers do all of that kind of thing very nicely, and they can read that, you know, the text to speech. So you can do a whole bunch of things with the digital media that you can't do with a book. Much as we all enjoy going to a library and picking up a book, you know, for those of us who are able to do that, it's nice and tactile thing. But in that situation, in a prison, there are lots of moves to at least augment that physical stuff with digital stuff, because it just makes much more sense. You can, if a prisoner wants to borrow a book, you know, they don't have to wait for somebody else to bring it back and all of that sort of thing. You leverage the digital nature. Once upon a time, this is the kind of thing we're doing now, but once upon a time we wouldn't have been able to do it because everybody would have been too worried about the Daily Mail complaining about prisoners getting Kindles and that sort of thing. Things seem to have changed a little bit. At least the government seem to be less worried about that now.
Yeah, it's interesting. The legal textbooks, though, is because I think that the, you know, the magazine industry now, it looks like they'll actually give stuff away for free. They're not really that bothered, because what they're really concerned about now is maintaining audience numbers. And if they've got a low cost of distribution for their content with things like Readly, with the, you know, the number of comps that are given away with things like airlines, all of that kind of stuff, yeah, actually they just want audience. Similarly, I think that the book publishing world has sort of got its head around new business models. It's still not quite there, but it's kind of, you know, it's sustained by the print market that seems to be rising again now. But then you've also got things like Amazon, Kindle Prime services, where, you know, the idea of leasing books out has kind of floated now. It's interesting, though, that the professional publishing stuff is one area where I think there's still probably a struggle to the idea of giving away information at a much lower cost than there was before. So it'd be interesting to see how that pans out. But I'd love to know actually how book publishers generally are thinking about the world of libraries in the world going forward, because I don't think I've seen anything around it. They must be, you know, absolutely thinking about it, because it must be a reasonable source of revenue for them. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it develops over the next few years.
So now we get to the interview, Matt, and you spent some time talking to Jew Jennison, and she's a bit of a business coach, isn't she? She works with companies to go through change and management alignment and that kind of thing. And she also uses Equine Friends for this piece of work as well.
She does. I met her at the Names Not Numbers conference back in September, and management training with horses sounds a little bit out there. Because it is a little bit out there, but actually her background is kind of big, sensible, big corporate stuff. She's not what you'd stereotypically think of as somebody doing this kind of slightly out there approach to getting people to be able to become better leaders. So I thought I'd have a chat with her, and so I did. So this is what we found out.
I'm Jew Jennison from Leaders by Nature, and I work with primarily with senior leaders and executives to help them be more aligned in their teams, and to help them navigate the uncertainty and substantial change. And many of my clients have accelerated their business results as a result of aligning their teams and working more cohesively together. I do it in a slightly unusual way. I do it by working with a herd of horses. So the clients will come out and work with me and my horses. I have five horses. And people often say, well, you know, why horses? What is it that's special about horses? The horses respond based on your nonverbal communication. So if you are very clear about where you're going, you provide a clear direction, you know exactly what you want and you execute with confidence, and you provide a strong relationship based on trust and respect, the horses will then come with you. So they want both. They want the clarity of direction and the relationship. And often we're good at one or the other. Often we're very focused on driving a result, or we're very focused on building a relationship, and we flip between one and the other. The horses will only come with us when we provide both. So it's really fine-tuning leadership and teamwork, because it's the clearest and cleanest feedback you'll ever get. There's nothing subtle about 600 kilograms of horse planting its feet and saying, no, not that. And they do it in a very non-judgmental way. So the beauty of that is that, you know, when we give each other feedback in the workplace, we often give it in the form of, don't do that, do this, which has my perspective and my agenda on it. So even though we wrap feedback up in a much more skilled way than don't do that, do this, that's the essence of what we're actually doing. Whereas the horses just say it's a yes or it's a no. So they either come or they don't. And when the horses are coming with clients, then we're looking at what are the strengths? What is it that you're demonstrating that is enabling them to want to engage and want to come with you through free will? And when they're not coming, it's a chance to explore, what is it that's missing? Do you trust them? Have you built a strong enough relationship? Are you being clear enough? All of the things that derail us at work will derail us when we try and lead a horse. So it provides very, very clear feedback and a chance to recalibrate in the moment. So often with training, we might identify, you know, I'm good at X, Y, Z, and I'm not so good at something else. But what we're actually doing is we're identifying all of that in the first half an hour of the day, which means that the rest of the day and over a longer period of time, we're able to look at how do you recalibrate. So if you know you're not good at relationship skills, how do you bring those in? Because actually all of us are good at those things. All of us can provide clarity and all of us can provide relationships, but we just don't always bring the two together. So it's a chance for people to explore individually as a leader and collectively within their team, how do we work and where do we get derailed?
So what's the sort of trigger for a client to come to you? What are the sorts of things that your clients are looking for when they come to work with the horses?
Well, I specialize in leading through uncertainty, and I've written a book of that name as well, and I also have a podcast of that name. And the reason why I specialize in leading through uncertainty is because the minute people walk through my gate, they have no idea what to expect. I mean, on paper, it's utterly bonkers. You're standing in a field about to get feedback from a horse on your leadership and teamwork. There's nothing on paper that sounds sane and sensible about that. And yet the work is enlightening and profound. So the uncertainty is a key piece to it. Often teams come to me when they're going through substantial change. So again, there's uncertainty when there's a high volume of change. So that might be, you know, a merger and an acquisition. It might be if you've got a new CEO, a newly formed team, or if a lot of the team have changed. Or, for example, it might be an exec board who have got a new strategy or launching new products, but generally there's substantial change going on that creates a lot of uncertainty and a reshifting within the team in terms of, you know, where are my responsibilities and how do I work with each of the individuals and then collectively, and what's my role within the team? And a lot of teams work in silos. So the finance director will do their job and the head of sales will do their job and the, you know, head of different business units are very good at executing their own objectives, but they're not always that good at supporting each other and communicating. And until they work cohesively, the whole of the organization can't align behind them. So it's really crucial that those top teams don't just work in silos, but they do completely align and have each other's backs.
I think, yeah, it's interesting. Some of the clients that I work with, we're working with technology leadership team, so the CIO or the CTO and their immediate reports. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the challenges often for those teams is that they don't really know what the purpose of the team is. And it's that silo thing that it's almost that there's they're a community because they all report to the same boss and they all have a similar level of responsibility and, you know, and accountability, but they don't actually work together because the nature of the work and the nature of the way in which we organize is such that they, you know, they have responsibility for their little fiefdoms, and actually often they'll then be in conflict with one another because, particularly when it comes to budget time, they're literally fighting each other for the same pot of money. So just even getting them to understand what their team function is there for can sometimes be a challenge.
And also what often gets highlighted is that there's often an overlap between roles and responsibilities. It's never as clear as I'm responsible for X and you're responsible for Y. There has to be some level of integration. And if that doesn't happen with the top team, then that integration just cannot happen throughout the whole of the organization. And, you know, when you've got large organizations, you know, particularly in the technology industry, where there's a lot of disruptive entrepreneurial companies coming through, the need for larger organizations to align and to really streamline is more important than ever before.
The sessions that you run, are you able to talk us through maybe at a sort of high level what they look like without ruining the surprise somebody might get?
Yeah, I mean,
you can't
ruin the surprise because it's such an embodied experiential experience. It's something that you feel. So, you know, when you, it's a bit like me trying to describe how you learn to ride a bike. You know, once you're on the bike and you've had wobbly moments and then you've had moments where you're in flow, you know what it feels like and you know how to do it. I think it's the same with leadership. We all have days where we know when it's a bit wobbly and clunky and awkward, and we have days where everything's just easy and flow. So a lot of what I'm doing with people is getting them to get that embodied experience of when am I in flow as a leader and in a team. So the mechanics of it would be that we would typically, and each day in a program, so I might work for one day or 2 days, or it might work over 6 or 12 months with a team. So they'll come back more than once. But a typical one day would look something like we'd start off by observing the horses. So it's a chance for the team to understand who's in their team, who are they going to have to lead. So we'll observe the horses in their environment, get a sense of what are the dynamics of the horse herd and their team. So really honing the levels of observation and starting to notice, because when we're working at 300 miles an hour, as most people are, we forget to pay attention. So it's really slowing things down and getting people to pay attention. So we start by doing that, but also to start exploring what's the emotional response that everybody's having, because observing the horses, depending on what the horses will do, some people in the team might be terrified to the point of almost overwhelm. Other people might be really excited and keen to get stuck in. Somebody might be bored because the horses aren't doing enough. And somebody might be feeling really calm and somebody might be feeling really anxious. And then we talk about that, because that in itself is quite interesting, in that whilst we're all in the same experience, just watching horses in a field, you've got a whole range of emotional responses, which of course is what we get in the workplace as well. But most of the time we don't realize it. So, you know, the project that you think is the best thing ever and you get really excited about, not everybody in the team has the same level of enthusiasm. And people don't always realize that. So it's a chance to say, oh, actually, just because I'm excited doesn't mean everybody is. Or just because I'm bored doesn't mean that I should switch off and not engage, because everybody else might be engaged. So we start there. And then we would do a mix of exercises. So we might start with leading a horse individually. So something as simple as leading a horse around an arena. The horses will come with you if you're clear and you've got a strong relationship. And again, they'll plant their feet if you're not. And again, the team will be observing each other with that. So they will see where are the struggles that people get stuck, and all of the default patterns of behavior that people have in the workplace show up exactly the same with the horses. So the ones who were the first to volunteer will be the ones that are first to volunteer with the horses. The ones who like to sit back and reflect will sit back and reflect. And we're able to have those conversations and explore, what does it mean for you if you're a sit back and reflector? What does it mean for you to dive in first and have a go? And just try different experiences and different ways of working. So we do that. And then the things that often frustrate each other in a team will be when somebody gets stuck. So normally we'll get annoyed with somebody for not doing something or for doing something in a particular way. Once they've experienced that and observed that with the horses, they realize that that person's just stuck. So it's not that that person's difficult or obstructive, that's where they get stuck. So instead of being frustrated with them, they learn to support each other through it. And that's where the teams start to really become more cohesive, because they start to recognize, I get that you're not just being difficult, you're actually struggling. And when you're struggling, instead of being cross with you, it's much better if I help you. So we'd do that. And then towards the end of the day, we'd build towards working as a team. So we might be leading one or two or even four horses as a team. And if one person in the team switches off or gets distracted, the horses stop. So it becomes really clear, where's your role in the team? Are you communicating effectively? And then, I mean, there's a whole range, but in its simplicity, that's what we're doing.
It feels to me like it's a method by which you're enabling people to be able to get back to the qualitative to an extent. That actually in senior leadership roles in most organisations now, there's such a heavy focus on the quantitative. If it hasn't got measured, if it isn't a number associated with it, I'm in control because I look at my dashboard that tells me where things are.
Exactly. You know, my first book was called Leadership Beyond Measure for that reason, because, you know, leadership and teamwork is not something we can nail down with metrics and numbers on a dashboard. And you know, and we try, we have competencies and, you know, engagement surveys. And so we try and measure those things, but ultimately it's something that we feel. Like, we know when we're in flow, we know when we're struggling, but we don't always pay attention to it. So what we're doing is putting the spotlight on, how does it feel in your body when you're struggling, so that you can actually stop struggling quicker and get back to that place of flow. I worked in IBM for years before I did what I'm doing now. So I've lived and breathed dashboards and run big budgets of $1 billion with dashboards. And, you know, they are sometimes used as a way of disconnection of, if we just get down to the numbers, it doesn't really matter about the people. But of course it does.
We've got this paradox. We have a incredibly connected world, but it's only connected at a very thin layer. We lose the visceral, we lose the tactile, we lose the actual connection.
Yeah.
And it becomes distilled down into the email or the dashboard or the...
Yeah. And yet if you ask people what are the moments in their life that they remember that are standout moments for them, they're moments of connection, they're moments of a visceral experience. So, you know, you remember when you've done a bungee jump, or you remember when you've been in a car accident, or, you know, weddings, funerals, family connections are moments that people always remember. And in fact, recently, one of my clients, I started doing this work 7 years ago, and one of my early clients posted on LinkedIn how a horse called Opus changed my life and helped me win a business award. And, you know, 7 years ago, this horse had given her an experience that I no longer remembered, but she absolutely remembered, not just, visually, but how it felt. So viscerally and emotionally, as well as mentally, she remembered everything about that experience and how it informed her even 7 years later, which I think is phenomenal. That's the power of connection.
Absolutely. Do you think there's something about management culture today that actually... to survive it, people do need to disconnect from feeling?
I think there's a balance. I think that part of, you know, when we're leading through uncertainty, part of uncertainty is it's uncomfortable. And that's going to be different for everybody. So part of that is disconnection. So part of the way that we deal with the discomfort is we disconnect, but what we need to do is come back. And if we're not careful and we disconnect completely all of the time, we become numb from the neck downwards, and then we're not really being very human, which means that we can't recognize when someone in the team is stressed, because we're so busy focusing on the transactional piece, we've forgotten to realize that, you know, I have emotions, you have emotions, and that the stress that we put people under has an impact. So yes, to a point, we sometimes need to be able to disconnect, but we need to come back, because otherwise we get the work-related stress and the mental health problems that are rife because people have repeatedly just disregarded their feelings. And if you've got somebody who's anxious or stressed over a long period of time, that has a major impact. And I think that's an issue for us at a societal level as well.
The idea of this being part of helping to deal with uncertainty, can you explore that a little bit more? The from what you said just then, it sounds like one of the key things there is actually being able to acknowledge the others around you when you're in times where you don't really know what's necessarily happening. Are there other aspects?
Yeah, so what happens in uncertainty is we have an emotional response. And so, you know, we've seen that with Brexit. There's fear, there's polarization, there's stress, there's overwhelm, and then there's disconnection. There's everybody has a different opinion about it, because by its very nature, uncertainty is not clear. It's we don't know. There isn't one direction and there isn't one answer. And so therefore you get polarization and then you get anxiety and stress around it. So that's normal. And, you know, one of the things that I say to people is whenever there's uncertainty and there's high volumes of change, you're going to get that in an organization. If we pretend that that's not happening, which is what we often do, it gets worse. We get more polarized if we don't speak to it. We get more stressed and anxious if we don't feel like we have a voice. So it's really important in those moments to recognize that there is an emotional impact individually and collectively that pervades the whole organization, and to look at how do we as human beings come together around that and move forward effectively, because we've still got a job to do. You know, so the results are still important. It's not results or relationship, it's both. So in order to achieve the results, we need to stay more connected, to be more aware of our humanity, to really start to listen and engage in dialogue. And by that I mean really listen behind the words. So, you know, when there's polarization in uncertainty and everybody's got a different opinion, the tendency is to try and make my point be heard and for my point to be right and yours to be wrong. What we really need to do is to have more curiosity and say, okay, Matt, I hear what you're saying, but I don't really understand why. What is it? You know, what are your values? What's important to you behind that? And we have to actually slow down to have that level of dialogue, to really get behind the words and the essence of what people are trying to get across and why they feel the way they feel and why they want certain things. So we start to understand their values, their belief systems, and what's important to them, and to articulate, you know, where our boundaries lie, what is acceptable and what isn't. You know, and technology is a great example of that, where the boundaries have become really blurred between, you know, our work and our life. You know, we're connected 24/7, often the phone and the, or, you know, the sort of iPad or whatever equivalent technology is the last thing people look at night, and it's the first thing pick up in the morning. You know, that blurs the boundaries, and we need to start being clearer about what is okay for me. Is it okay for me to send or receive an email at 11 o'clock at night? Is that okay? Or am I doing it because I think I should? So all of that has to come into play. You know, it's complex. There's no simple answer to any of this. It's something that we all need to pay attention to and make decisions for ourselves, and then say, well, how do we work with each other if I don't want to look at my technology after 7 p.m. and you're happy to at 11 p.m.? How do we work together in that way and still respect each other?
Yeah, it's the helping people to be able to understand how they work at the moment is often overlooked. I did quite a lot of work with teams to be able to help them be able to become better, more collaborative, whatever that means in the context of the organisation I'm working with. And my starting point always is finding ways for them to actually come to consensus about how they work today, because they often don't know. And that's not because of any dereliction of duty. It's just because in, you know, modern, complex, matrixed organisations, we sometimes don't even know which teams we're in, because they're many and varied. And then, you know, teams, the old Bruce Tuckman stuff about forming, norming, storming, performing, I see an awful lot of the time now that teams, because they're constantly in flux, just are bouncing between forming and storming and never get beyond that point because, you know, you have these people in for this part of the project and these people in for that part of the project, and at no point does anybody have to actually step back and say, who are we as a team? What are we needing to do? How are we working? Because there isn't time. And I think that, I mean, that sort of reflects at all sorts of levels in organisations.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm doing with the horses with, so sometimes I work with teams and sometimes I work with groups of individuals. So as part of a talent management programme, so it might be groups of people who are across an organisation who may or may not know each other. And when I work with groups of individuals in that way, what we're looking at is how do you come together as a team and go through that, you know, the forming to performing very, very quickly. So once people have an understanding of the need for respect within a team, the need for certain criteria of how do you communicate and how easy it is to derail each other and how easy it is to support each other, they're able to form and then disband teams much more quickly.
How often do you find that the teams that come along as opposed to the groups of individuals don't really know each other?
So I refer to a team as an intact team that is working together. So it might be an exec team or it might be a project team. When I refer to groups of individuals, I mean they're from the same company.
Yeah, sure. So, But so when you've got an intact team, how often is it that you find that there are people who just don't know each other within that team of people who are supposed to be working together?
I mean, usually they know each other, but not that well. So they don't understand each other's values or belief systems. For example, a classic one would be a sales team where they're out on the road and they very rarely see each other. They never think to pick up the phone and say, I've got a problem with this client. What's your experience of that? They wouldn't ever think about doing that until they realise the value of it. So that's quite common. And then quite often I'm working with teams who are newly formed. So they may have only met, you know, there may be, you know, I worked with a team recently and the head of strategy was 3 weeks into the job and 3 weeks into the company. So everybody was new and everything was new. And what happens is once people see each other and observe each other, they build that connection, they can just get off to a fast start because they've cut through all the noise and all of the kind of, you know, I call it dancing around the handbag piece that goes on in a team in that, you know, in that storming phase. A lot of it is before you get to the storming, there's that bit where, is it okay to say this? Can I say that? Who's jostling for position and where do I fit? We cut through all of that in about half an hour, you know, so we cut through months of jostling for position very, very quickly.
It's almost finding ways to enable them to have conversations that they've got a third element to base the conversation around. So you're using horses. I tend to use Lego quite a lot for this kind of thing, which slightly more portable, but
probably less of a connection.
Well, I don't know. They connect very well, and also able to inflict pain onto a foot. But the reason by making outside, it's interesting that actually if you can make the conversation about something outside of them, it enables them to open up about themselves much more than if you directly say, right, you talk to that person and tell them your feelings and your innermost thoughts. And it's, you
know. And then everybody clamps up. Yeah. No, exactly. But also the relational piece with the horse is the crucial piece, which I think is the bit that accelerates the learning, because in order to get the horse to want to be in the team and come with you. So I always say, you know, the horse is a member of your team, not a problem to be fixed and not an object to be moved from A to B. So if you want the horse to come with you, you need to create an environment where the horse just says, actually, that's a team I want to be in. I'll just follow. So it takes away coercion, and it's all about the relationship and the communication and the cohesion of the team. So they're able to find it, and so it's the visceral experience of that, and then we have the conversation afterwards to try and unpick and get the intellectual and the cognitive understanding of that. But it's the visceral experience of, we know what it felt like when we were so in flow the horse just wanted to be with us. And we also know what it felt like when the horse didn't. And that's the piece that they're able to recreate really quickly, because they know what they shifted to be able to do so.
Do you ever get people who feel they can't engage with it? That I mean, either just a, like, mortal fear of horse, or that because it's too out there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say 50% of the people who walk through the gate are very sceptical or terrified and don't want to be there. So often they come because the sponsor or the leader of the team has made the decision, and so the team come, and you get the same that you would get in any period of change in an organization. You get those who come and go, I can't wait, this is really exciting. And then you get those who go, this is rubbish, I don't see the point of this. You know, and I wrote in my book about an experience, and this is an experience that's happened two or three times, so it's not just one person, but two or three times I've gone to shake somebody's hands, and they've arrived, and they've brushed past me and sat down in my office and said, this is completely pointless, I don't know why we're here, this is a complete waste of time, we've got stuff to be doing that we should be doing. And all that is just fear. It's resistance, is just fear. It's fear of, I'm in an environment I don't know, I don't understand it, I don't know how it's going to play out, that I have no control over it. And of course, that's
the
uncertainty.
Point, isn't it? Yeah.
And usually those people are the ones who are the most obstructive at work as well, because they're the ones that will go, this isn't going to work and we shouldn't do it and we've tried it before. And, you know, all of those patterns that we play out at work, they just show up. And I always say resistance is just fear. And often the people who are most resistant and really make it, you know, say it's just stupid, they're so frightened of being frightened that they don't even feel fear. So it's, you know, back to what you were saying earlier around, you know, do we sometimes need to disconnect our emotions? Sometimes those people have disconnected from fear because it's too uncomfortable. So they learn to handle their fear by saying, no, I'm not doing it because it's stupid. And whenever we get, no, I'm not doing it because it's stupid, I know that almost certainly underneath that is fear. And it's, how do we help those people navigate it and feel more comfortable? So as soon as I get that resistance, and there'll always be at least one person that is, you know, that's an extreme example, but there'll always be at least one person there. And sometimes they'll say, I don't want to be here. And sometimes they'll just think it. But within half an hour, the horses know it. So the horses sense all of the stuff that we're rumbling behind the eyes. So energetically, they're very, very sensitive. So you only need to be a tiny little bit scared and they'll know. And they also have an ability to know, when are you so scared that you're at a point of overwhelm and that huge resistance. And often with those people, the horses will be very gentle, because they'll realise that actually that person needs to be supported, they need to be helped, they need to come with them. So, I mean, I've watched, particularly my mare, who's very, very sensitive and very intuitive, I've watched her with someone who's been quite rude with me, and or on the face of it, it looks like rudeness, but again, I just recognise it's something else. And I think, crikey, if they're like that with her, she's going to headbutt them into next week. Because if you yank her around on the end of a lead rope, she will headbutt you, which I think fair enough, actually. but she will, sometimes with those people, she'll be really gentle. And I'll think, that's really odd. Why is she doing that? I thought she'd plant her feet and refuse to move. But what she recognises is that actually what that person needs is support, and to start to bring their overwhelm down so that they can function. And then once they've led the horse once and they've got success and they realize they're not stupid and they're not being found out, then they start to embrace it, and then the horses will start to challenge those people more. So that in itself I always find really fascinating, that, you know, I always say everyone will have moments in the day where the horses come and moments where the horses plant their feet, and everybody's moment will come at different times, and the horses just know exactly when to do it. It's incredible.
So it's interesting, Matt. That was a really good interview, and I guess it makes us think about what people think about when they are thinking about the business of IT, not IT, but business change and business leadership, and the way she talks about fear quite a lot at the end of that interview.
Yeah, I think, I really want to go up and spend some time seeing how this all fits together in the large amount of flesh, because it's... every Saturday morning I take the kids to sport in a sports centre nearby us, and we go past some stables on the way there, and actually just looking at them over the last few weekends since I did that interview, and just thinking about the sheer mass of those things, and how, you know, what Jude was saying about how you have to be able to get them to trust you and work with you and go with you, and if you just try to pull them, if you just try to hit them to do it, whatever else, they dig in and they're not going to do it. And that isn't a metaphor that should be lost on people for how an awful lot of management goes on within organisations. And the thing for me, actually, I think is actually, are we fearful now, as we've become increasingly disconnected because of the technology we put in between us, have we become fearful of actually expressing feelings, of being able to connect with people, because that in somehow isn't what we do in business anymore? That to be in business is to be a machine, it's the part of the mechanism, not a cell within the organism.
I think that's a fair point. You know, if you tried to create a machine to force a horse to do what you wanted to do, that would be a big, powerful machine. And you might get there, it might do that, but actually that's not the point. The horse needs to want to do what you're asking it to do. And whether that's through coercion at the first, so that until the horse understands that it's going to enjoy it and that there's going to be something in it for it, then you need to use different tricks, don't you? And sometimes you have to put blinkers on a horse, and sometimes you have to give it some negative reinforcement as well as positive reinforcement, and that's all part of the process. But and they're also cleverer than that. We give them credit for. I think. I mean, I know the horsey people will say that they know all sorts of things that they actually don't. But there's a thing about a horse where I often walk past the horses. The horses in the field near where I live, and I'll walk past them. Sometimes, if I'm feeling generous, I'll give them some grass or something to eat, and they'll come along and they'll have a munch and look at you in a kind of, well, thanks for the grass, mate, but it doesn't make us friends way. And they do have this trick of being able to. I don't know if you ever work with horses, but sometimes they'll come up and they'll come and stand on your foot, and they'll stand on your foot, and then they'll just very slowly take all the weight off all their other feet whilst looking at you in the eye with that, you know, with the one eye on the one side of their head. And there's nothing you can do about it until they finally go away. And it's just their way of telling you that, you know, they've got your number, mate.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I very... very young, I went on the back of a horse and it rolled with me on, so I've always been very fearful of the things.
They are pretty good judges of character as well, you know. It's probably,
anyway, thank you. Exactly. Thank you to Jude for spending the time chatting to me. We'll put a link to her website on the website, on our website, and you can find out more about what she does there. Right, so we've managed to be able to career our way lungingly to another termination of a show. I don't know, none of those words make any sense at all, but, you know, it's been a long show. Thank you for joining us again. What have we got coming up on the show next week?
Well, we definitely have an interview with Darren Timmins, who's one of the, or probably the most the brightest data, big data people that I know. And I think we might be able to whistle up a yin and a yang, Matt.
Well, it'll be a yin and a yang if we don't get more contributions for the I Must Read It Again feature, which, quite frankly, if you've got this far in the show, you're a committed listener. And I can almost certainly say you haven't done one yet. Why not? Come on, we need contributions. If you want to do that, you can find out all the instructions on the WB40 Podcast website at wb40podcast.com. Click on the menu, you'll find the I Must Read It Again. There's a series of questions. You just record yourself answering those. I'll do the magic to make it sound like a beautiful thing. And then we can have some more books that you can share with people that you really must get round to. Otherwise, it's one of you or me doing one, actually. I think we'll do that rather than a yin and a yang. So,
maybe that. We can do one. But that, I mean, the listeners do need to pull their finger out, because otherwise we're going to have to put a Patreon or something on and people are going to have to pay instead.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a good incentive.
Absolutely. Content or payment. This is how we've got to on this show now. Content or payment. Anyway, have a great week. Look forward to catching up with you again next week. And let's hopefully see that there'll be something happens politically this week. You never know.
Thank you for listening. You can, as always, catch us at our website at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, on all of the great podcasting platforms that you all use, no doubt. And of course, if you do that and there's an opportunity to leave us a review, then please do that, because it makes us all very happy when you do.